I've been asked to call another witness, and then we're going to close with a couple of songs to close up the opening, and then we'll get on with some more speakers. We have a grandmother here from the Haida Gwaii's, so I'd like to ask Levina, and I'd like to apologize maybe not knowing her Haida name, Levina White, but I'd like to ask Levina White to come up and be a witness.
I'd like to welcome you all to this conference, and I hope you enjoy it. It's a beautiful day, and it was nice of you to come on the first nice day of this summer. That's a hard act to follow. My name is Dalhegus, and the reason I mention it now is we have a conference coming up next week, and the Aboriginal people that we've invited from around the world all have their own names within their language. And it really shows what Canada has done to us when I see all the names there, and Canada is only one that has white names. So no matter what's been done anywhere, at least they've retained their names. I want to thank the people who put this together and who have given me the honor to be a witness. I know you'll have good gathering, and you'll hear many things. Probably some of them are hard to accept, but that's the way it's been. I, for one, was put through the boarding school system, and I've always felt that I was robbed of my childhood. The permit system that Rose talked about is one that we've resisted for a long, long time, and that's why there's so many cases in the courts. The reason that they criminalize us instead of having civil courts is because that's the only way they have jurisdiction over us, is to criminalize us over everything. The systems that we live within have to be changed. And the responsibility lies with you and with us. And I want to talk to the support group and thank them for all the help that they've given so far, and I know that they will continue to support us in our struggle. For it's not a struggle that we can win by ourselves. It's a struggle that we can win only when Canadians realize what has happened to us. And you can be proud of the day when it comes that the Native people are the sovereign people of this country. And as you heard, the former people that just spoke all mentioned the fact that we're all different nations. We have commonalities, but we're all different nations, much as Europe is different nations. And yet they expect us all to think alike. When at the First Minister's conferences, they decided that we didn't know what we wanted because we all said different things. They don't seem to realize that we're different nations and that we have slightly different ways and different languages and different cultural protocol even. We have a lot of commonalities, the land being one of them. In the Americas, there was nothing more important than your land, your environment, and the waters, whether it was ocean or river. And it is to this day the most important thing, and our highest law is to learn respect, respect. It's the highest law we have. And I think that applies to every different nation within Canada and within the states. All the Indians of this continent, that's the first thing you're taught right from the cradle, is respect and consent. So our laws are very ancient, and they're constant. They never change. They don't change for anyone's convenience or for any purpose. They remain as they were from the beginning. I come to you from very ancient people. The Haida Nation has been in that place on Haida Gwaii from the beginning of time. It says when Raven finished creating the world, and Raven is the symbol of the Creator, when he finished creating the world, he enticed mankind out of a clamshell. And I always thought men and women came out of the clamshell, the same clamshell. The clamshell, of course, is the symbol again. Just the men came out of the clamshell. Further south on the island, womankind came out of a mussel shell. And I think something new had been added in the late ages, because they say womankind came out of the mussel shell and there were vicious, mean-looking creatures. I think that was added just recently, because there never used to be chauvinism. But that's our history. We've been here since the beginning of time. We didn't come across a land bridge, as a lot of people would like you to believe. And because of the land issue, you will hear many stories that are contrary to ours. The system that was imposed on us is in direct conflict with our ways. But we've bent over backwards trying to fit in. And we can't fit in because our value system is so different. Yours is good for you, ours is good for us. And I hope that the Canadian government will finally realize that we have to have our own system. And I don't mean a third level. We don't want a third level of government for Indian people. We want to have our own system that is equal to theirs. And we want a percentage of the GNP to run our affairs. I really think that the land issue, when it comes around, I'm hoping as an elder that they go the same way as our ancestors wanted it after after contact, when they realized their lands were being taken away. They were required to come and talk to us and get our consent before they moved on to our lands. But that hasn't been done in British Columbia. I feel we've been discriminated against. We don't have the same right as they did east of the Rockies. They went and got the consent of the Indian people east of the Rockies, but not in British Columbia. And they have not got our consent to this day. I believe that on our island, they need to come and talk to us, not us to them, as Rose said. They need to get our consent as to how we're going to coexist on our lands, for our lands are not negotiable. Our lands will be the Haida land from the beginning to the end, and it will never be negotiated. It's how we coexist on there that's to be negotiated, and how we share the resources that's to be negotiated. We want finally to become the nation that we were at the time of contact, strong, rich, and confident. We've been subjected to many things, far more than you'll ever be able to hear. Our identities were stolen, our lands were taken. I don't think there's anywhere else in this world that even your names are taken away from you, not just your lands, but your names. No right to use your name. In fact, the Inuit had names or numbers tattooed on their hands because they couldn't pronounce their names. My last name is White in the English way. I can't believe that we would have a name like that. And before I used to be light brown, now I'm white. Oh dear, the things we've been put through. The support group has been really helpful in this, and we hope that we can build a bridge of understanding between us and that the support continues, not only in the southern area here, but in the north. For in the north, we have a lot of problems too. The process of the land issue is one that was hard to win, and now they want to impose it on us very quickly and get it done with. It reminds me of a meeting that I went to just out of curiosity one time. The separatist group was having a meeting, and I wanted to see who was saying all these things that we say about our lands and resources. So I went to the meeting. And to my surprise, they were saying all the things that the first people of this land say. I asked them, I said, what are you going to do about the native land question? They said, we'll finish it once and for all. And I knew the way they said it, what they meant. So we have the women's movement and the Indian movement have gone on about the same number of years. And neither the women's movement nor the Indian movement have got very far with the system that we exist in. The system has to be changed. The educational process has to be changed. Because what happens in your educational process is you're taught exactly what you're not made to listen, I mean, to use your own ideas. You're programmed for a system that they laid out for you. And that system only looks after the powerful and the rich. I don't know any poor person that can run for office so you could change things. The system that they laid out for us gives more money and more power to those who already have enough. In our systems, we have different ways of explaining sovereignty. Sovereignty is a word that we should not be afraid of. And the more we have sessions like this with the non-Indian people, the better you'll understand how we feel and what we're doing. We use your science and technology, and I would love for you in return to use our philosophies, especially in regards to the lands and the environment and the waters. I'm old enough to remember how sweet the water was to run down to a creek and have a drink. We can no longer do that. I remember the elders when I was young, how difficult it was for them when they saw all their logs going out on barges and that we couldn't even go into the woods to build our houses or even to get wood. In fact, at one point, the people weren't allowed to get logs even off the beach for their firewood. You're only allowed to get so many clams. You're only allowed to get it if you have a permit. I remember what it was like to be free. And that's what we want to go back to, being free on our own lands. It was wonderful. None of our systems are for control or for power or for prestige. Our systems are for responsibility. It's a great system. Even our religion is free. You are the church. So how you conduct yourself is entirely up to you. And the only way that a parent has to teach their children is by example. We had an educational system. The uncles taught the children and the aunts taught the children because parents can't be objective about their children. And the only way that a parent could teach was by example. And so our systems were all in place, as you heard the former speakers say. They were all in place, and there were very highly specialized tribal groups. Some of them were the canoe makers. Others were the artists that did the totem poles that told the story of your family. And every tribe had its purpose. And one of the first things that we're taught in speaking about purpose is to teach children at their level that you mustn't disturb anything of nature. And they had those certain stories to teach children at that level. I did the first Indian banners in Vancouver in 71, I think it was, or 73, somewhere around there. And I did a banner with little frogs on it and grandfather's face and two long tears and boys' faces, because the story that they used to tell the boys had to do with the volcanic eruption. They were taught to look after the fires when they first went out hunting. That was their job. And of course, as little boys will, they got bored with everything. And they start throwing frogs in the fire, and we're always taught not to disturb anything of nature. So the story goes that the two boys were the only ones that were lost in the volcanic eruption. And they used to tell the children these stories so that they would know that they must not disturb anything of nature. For if we disturb nature, then we are not nurtured by nature. That is our religion. Everybody's ignored our religion. Everybody in the world has their religions honored. And I want to thank you for giving us the support to get back to our freedom and to get back to our religions and our systems, for they served us well. And I want to thank the ones who invited me to be a witness. And I think it's wonderful that so many people turned out for this on such a beautiful day. Thank you very much. Thanks, friend.
Like to sing one more song for you people, and it's a friendship song. So you guys, don't be shy to look at who's sitting next to you and shake their hands and make your acquaintance. Kokstum Kauhyamashnukwa. Thank you very much, good friends.
I guess maybe to explain, part of my ancestry is with the Lillooet people. My great-great-grandmother married into their tribe and lived up there, and I have a right to sing with the Lillooet Nation singers. Also, I have two children from Mount Currie also, so that's why I was able to get up and sing with them. So I think that getting close to closing our this part of the agenda, I would just like to say a few words on that we'd like to, the Squamish people would like to share with our support people here. Last year when the Mohawk people were invaded by the Sûreté du Québec, we had our one of our first war council meetings in well over 120 years. We spent 2 days discussing the issues around Oka. Because we are allied with the Mohawk people, the Squamish, to the Assembly of First Nations. And we knew that we had to stand up and with our allies, the Mohawk people. And we sat down for 2 days deciding how we were going to support. And one of the things we did is we did a picket at the Lionsgate Bridge just to show that we do have the same type of bridges that go through this area that we can support in those when it comes to direct action. We know at times, we said at times, there are times when we have to block bridges sometimes, even when we have to burn bridges, and there are other times that we have to build bridges. And we said we wanted to, at that point we said that we wanted to build bridges with the public. And for the first time in our history, the Squamish opened up our longhouse 2 times last summer. And it was initiated by the chief and council, and it was actually a change in our tradition. We had about 800 people from the public show up one night, and then 2 weeks later. And we wanted to explain what our position was on land claims, sovereignty, nationhood, self-determination, and we also wanted to explain why we stood up with the Mohawk people in support of them during their crisis. And I also understand that the South Island people opened up their longhouse and the Musqueam opened up their longhouse in the same type of fashion. Because we view this as very important that we sit down and discuss and talk how we're going to coexist together, because we know that we're here together. We have to learn how to coexist, and we wanted to explain what our position was to the public. Also, we've had an international mining company we've hosted in our longhouse. We've also hosted the national, it was all the representatives of the high schools from across Canada were hosted in our longhouse. We also had a lot of unions of Tin Whis were in our longhouse, I think about a month ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago. Some support groups, also unions and whatnot, that we sat down and had this dialogue. So it's very important that we understand each other, and it's very important that you understand what our positions are. We tried to share it with you here today that we are from various First Nations. We have our common things that are common to us, but we also have our differences, very much like the European people. I've been told that British Columbia is equivalent to is the Europe of North America. We've got the highest concentration of separate First Nations in any area in North America. It's because of the geography. Like I said, I can go 100 miles north and we're into a different nation, the Lillooet Nation. We have the Stalos who are our neighbors on this side, our Musqueams on this side, Seychelles on this side. Very close range, but when you get to other parts of North America, like the Cree cover almost three provinces. So what we did here today was we tried to share in whatever way we could, dealing with different First Nations protocols. We tried to share with you. We tried to show the respect to each other, to our elders, because we're told that respecting our elders means we have to respect the experience. respecting experience, because our elders hold that experience and knowledge, and they're very valuable, and I know all our First Nations in the coast here, the elders are very valuable and are very, very well respected, and we tried to show that to you and share that with you today.
The next speaker I would like to introduce you to is a woman who is very active in doing all kinds of work in many different areas. She's been active doing intercultural training workshops with different agencies, including the Vancouver City Police, the Justice Institute, various health agencies, as well as various educators and professional groups. She is of the Gitxsan Tribal Group and has a title which empowers her with a variety of responsibilities to her extended family. She has spent more than 30 years designing and carving in the tradition of her Tsimshian Gitxsan ancestors. She apprenticed under her father, William G. Jeffrey, in the medium of large totem pole carving, and studied further at the famous Gitanmak School of Northwest Coast Indian Art at Kasan. She now specializes in two-dimensional art forms, working in wood, cloth, silver, and ceramic. In fact, you may view some of her work here today in the resource room, where she's active selling sweatshirts for the struggle of the Gitxsan Wet'suwet'en people. Please welcome Alice Jeffrey.
I usually like to keep my speeches short and sweet, just the same way as I am. So I'm going to look at my watch throughout this time and leave it open afterwards so that we can have an open panel so that you would have an opportunity to ask questions. Thank you very much, Viola. It's always amazing when you're asked to speak somewhere and they ask you to send a biography or whatever you call it. And the only thing that I had, and I must say that I thank you for that wonderful, wonderful introduction. I haven't been able to set my hand to paint or to carve or to do anything for the last 2 years, and especially since the decision came down on March the 8th. My husband rarely sees me. I just crawl into bed at night, and that's the extent of our relationship right now. Where I originate from, we really don't start by just talking. So I always feel comfortable if I start in the way that we are supposed to start. So I will then deal with your topic, and I'll start off in a very formal way. Simgiget sigidamanak kubuwilksil gadam kaltsap toer si nisim lul silksatun wilwin adisim egwin kwisekl wil amagigetsim iwansim. Oer sinism, lipnitz morgidem zum nachatem and den chnum, lalkaleren chnium. Prince, princesses, chiefs, chieftainesses, and people of the community. It is my honor to be here this afternoon to represent the Gitxsan and the Wet'suwet'en people. We are a people that originate from the watershed area where the Skeena originates. And the Skeena in our language is not Skeena. That's why we got the name Gitxsan. Xian is what we call the Skeena River. Gitxian. Git means man of the Xian. That's what we are. The other people that we are currently side by side with in our litigation is called Wet'suwet'en. And they originate from the Bulkley until it flows into the Skeena. And that's their territorial boundaries. When Tom Somburn asked me to speak, I didn't pay much attention to his topic until I got here, and then I started to sweat blood, I must tell you. I thought, what is colonization? You know? So I ran to Colleen here because she isn't here now, but I spoke to the Coalition of Labor, and I said, what is colonization under the definition of the law or under the definition of Webster's Dictionary? She says, I don't know. So I then went to the kitchen. I said, what is colonization? Oh, there's somebody who's written an article. Let's go and have a look at this article. At any rate, the definition that we came up with is that colonization is a method either by use of physical or legal aggression. And when you look at the history of Canada, it's really amazing. When you talk to anybody from our area or from my father's people, and even from Levina's people, because a part of my roots originate from the Haidach also, they always talk in terms of the queen. They always talk about the queen, and prior to the queen, they talked about the king. That's how they felt, and that's where they felt that their negotiations originated from. And Canada is interesting, as Mr. Rivers explained to you. We as Aboriginal people never realized, I guess, for many, many years that we were being colonized. Because when you look at Canadian history, in 1763, when the first non-native landed and began to settle in along the St. Lawrence and in through Nova Scotia, they overtook the French, and then it became British. So every time anybody talks to me about colonization, I always think of English. I don't know why. That's the first thing that pops in my head. But it's an interesting time in history when the English took over. Because through King George V, he put forth a proclamation, which is called the Royal Proclamation of 1763, in which he said, all the lands that were to the west, and you must remember at this time in history, that the in European history, for example, Scotland, all of the and other people were forced out of their ancestral lands. They were starting to come into Canada. Other Welsh people were also forced out of their ancestral lands. They were starting to come into Canada to start this settlement process. The reason I'm telling this little bit before you is so that you understand, and because a lot of people will say at 1763, they really didn't know what was beyond the Rockies. That's not true. Because these first Scotch people, Welsh people, Irish people, and some very, very impoverished English people came across. And they were the first fur traders that did a lot of trade with our people with what was then called the Northwest Coast or the Northwest Trading. So what King George said, and this is why I said that my father, who is 91 years young today, always tells me, daughter, don't you ever confuse what we're talking about. It's not land claims. What we're talking about is Aboriginal rights, and we have never seceded our Aboriginal rights from time immemorial, and we still recognize our Aboriginal rights and amongst ourselves. And he says, when you talk about in terms of colonization or government today, it still goes back to the Royal Proclamation of 1763, in which King George said, all the lands going out to the west and to the north were recognized as sovereign nations. Sovereign nations. Even in today's court of law, you cannot enter into a treaty agreement unless you're a sovereign nation. That really says a lot when you think in terms of what my father and their generation perceive our current fight. So from 1763, we then come to 1867, Confederation. What is happening? You're asking about the impacts, and my gosh, you're really getting a history lesson today. In 1867, out of Section 69 of the British North American Act came the Indian Act. And it's interesting when you look from 1867 right until about the outbreak of the Second World War, the Department of Indian Affairs was housed under the War Ministers Act. And when you think about it, this tells you an awful lot about the thinking and the philosophy that went in regard to the control of Canada's Indigenous people. And that did not change until after the Second World War between 1944 and 1945, in which it was transferred to mines, minerals, and resources. Then we became still Indian Affairs. And I still find it amazing today that no matter which paper you pick up, they're still talking about us as their Indian problem. I never realized we were a problem. And When you talk of, now I'd like to talk about what colonization meant to me and its personal impact. I grew up in a very small community that was called Sigetoch, which is now called Glenfall, which was named after an Indian agent, but we call it Sigetoch. And I came from a family of 10. I have 6 older brothers and 3 sisters, and I was the second youngest. And it's still very part of our culture today to adopt our brothers or our sisters or our cousins' children. And my mother's sister was barren. She had no children. So my older brother, who has now since died, George, and myself were raised by our aunt. And our aunt was known as Mlulik. That was her chieftain name. We never called them by their Christian names. Her Christian name was Miriam. But in our house, we called her Mlulik when I grew up. The old man who raised me, we called him Talauksumlaha. That's how I grew up. I thought that there was nothing else in the world but Gitxens. I thought the whole world was Gitxen. These people that raised me were very reluctant to let me go when it was time for me to be educated. And much like Frank had told you, my parents left the reserve of Kispiaks in 1942 when some of my older brothers were born. And they moved to Prince Rupert for the specific reason of education, because they felt at that time the education level was only an Indian day school, or the other option was to send us off to residential school. And my parents were very jealous of their children. They wanted to keep their children with them. So as a result, all my older brothers and sisters became disenfranchised. We were brown, white people walking around in Prince Rupert. So I'm 7. These people don't want to send me off to school. And I can remember going on to the train. The train used to take 12 hours from Hazleton to go to Prince Rupert. It was one of those old steam locomotives. Now I am really dating myself. And at that time, I didn't realize we were being segregated. And I never realized this until I started to do these workshops, and one of my older sisters happened to attend my workshop, and she got very indignant at what I was telling people. The train that we went on had a car that was segregated, in which only we as Native people were allowed to go and sit. We couldn't go into any other parts of the train through the duration of our trip. And I can remember also, when my mother was very young, she contracted Parkinson's disease, and she required specialized medical attention. And our hospital was inequipped to do this, so we would go to Smithers by train. And when we went to Smithers, we were only allowed from the train station to the hospital. We could not enter into any stores. We could not go into any restaurants. And it's so wonderful. Children have no discrimination or segregation. And so we would buy Kool-Aid from children that were selling it on the street before we went back on the train. And I remember my sister, when I was telling the boys in blue, that's what I call the Vancouver City Police, as Viola said, I did a lot of workshops with them. I don't know how you make them aware or sensitize them, but we sure did it, tried a good job. So that was my first introduction to the non-Native community. And like many of the other people that you have probably heard from, I went to a regular school. It was called King Edward School in Prince Rupert. And again, my parents did not want us to speak. They never spoke our language, like Tsimshian and Gitxsan are almost similar. In fact, when you're in the feast house, which we call the Liligit, that you know as the Patlach, we have a language which we call Simalgich, which is a language that is recognized by the Nisra, Tsimshian, and the Gitxsan. And this was a language that my parents would use if they wanted to tell each other things that nobody else was supposed to hear. But they always forgot that George was already married, but I was young and I always knew the language. But again, when I first went to school, colonization again, I couldn't speak a word of English, and it was really an impossible thing. And it's terrible how life is, because you always remember the most negative things rather than the good things. I can still remember my first grade teacher's name. Her name was Miss Porliade. And the only reason I remember her is because every time I couldn't speak English, she'd slap me with a ruler and pull my hair. And I put up with this for almost a full year, and before the school year was ended, I asked one of the other families, who was the Crosby family at that time, who was an extended relative of ours, to come and translate for me while I talk to the principal. So I spoke to the principal, and I told him, if I was to teach this woman Gitxsan every day, and I strapped her and I pulled her hair, she would learn nothing. So I was moved from that classroom, and then I went on into another class and was able to get on through school. But a lot of things were happening during that time. At that time, our people were very strongly involved in the fishing industry. There wasn't major license quotas, and they were very self-sufficient people, I must tell you this. When I look back today, in fact, I just met somebody from Campbell River, and they had asked me if I remembered the old Chief Robinson. He was a millionaire. He owned a fleet of ships, and he fished every ocean fishery that you could think of. And the same story was true in amongst the Haidach and the Tsimshian and the Kwagyut nations. So there was sort of a paradox that was happening at the same time. So from the 40s to 56, our people became very involved in developing a society that was called the Native Brotherhood. And the Native Brotherhood is the founding political movement organization in British Columbia. And you must remember, just like my friend here, Frank, said, legislation posed that up to 1956, Native people were not to congregate other than for religious purposes. As a result of this, even today, the Native Brotherhood's anthem is Onward Christian Soldiers. And if you talk to anybody from Bella Bella up to Port Simpson that are still older, they'll tell you, you could hear that RCMP boat coming for miles, so you could be in a rip-roaring religious mood before they got there. Little did they realize that our parents were talking about the education of their children, their grandchildren, and not only the education, but they were talking about other benefits which the Brotherhood instituted, which is family allowance and old age pension. So I want you to know that that is the parent organization in British Columbia. And that's what my grandfather and my father and my uncles and aunts, and I bet you Levina's parents were right in that too. Yes, that's what I thought. And when you look at, again, colonization, let's go on from 1956 when you're not allowed to congregate other than for religious purposes. 1956 is also a major year in which our people were allowed to consume alcohol in a licensed establishment. Prior to that, that doesn't mean we didn't drink. We weren't allowed to, it was illegal. But you could only go, and as a result of that, a lot of us felt this is where this power drinking syndrome came from, where people, our relatives, would drink and drink and drink and drink and drink and drink and drink until you get pissed. And you didn't learn the graces like you have in the non-native society in regard to alcohol and restraint. So it's taken many, many years to overcome that, also 1956. We're still talking about colonization. Sorry to take so long. 1958 is a big year for us. 1958 is the first year that we're recognized as Canadian citizens. If you read the Indian Act, prior to 1958, we're not even considered human beings. We're not eligible for purchasing any major things or acquisitions prior to 1958. So 58 is the first year that we're allowed to vote as Canadians. So then from 1958, we go into 1969. 69 is a big year, wasn't it, Viola? You remember that? This is one little radical little lady sitting here. Another one sitting over there who I always tease once in a while, Levina. The fight has never stopped. It doesn't matter which age group that you go through or Native people. You will see that it is always taken up each time. 1969 was the year when Trudeau introduced what was called a white paper policy. And what the white paper policy was to do was to make reserves into municipal status, and by law, extinguish Aboriginal rights and fiduciary, is that the fancy word they use now? Fiduciary responsibilities to us as Native people. So from 1969 is also a big year too, because the government's got a real big push. They decided that we as Native people should be self-determining, so that all of the money that you read in, that comes out every 4 years on the federal fiscal, is then going to be decentralized to people in bands. And this is when you begin to see the real formation of band councils, and then band councils, like we in the Hazleton area, got really smart like everybody else. We band together, so we'd have 7 reserves, so that we could talk to the MLAs and MPs, and we'd say, hey, we got a $6,000 voting rights. Now, what are you gonna do for us? So we started to learn the political system. And that's when you see the formation of tribal councils. Funding is being decentralized by the Department of Indian Affairs to each of the bands so that they can then run their own programs, but only limited. Let me tell you, it's limited. You are allowed to run your education programs, but they're very limited in the fact that education today is still handled, isn't that correct, Frank, by the federal government through the Master Tuition Agreement. That hasn't changed. That's a tripartite agreement between the federal government, provincial government, and municipalities. So the major control in regard to us voicing our opinions in regard to curriculum or history about Native people being employed into the school system has still not been recognized or really been dealt with. It's an ongoing battle. When you talk about social services, sure, we looked after social services program. But again, that's a tripartite agreement also between federal, provincial, and municipal. Housing. Interesting when you look at colonization of Indian people again and today's history. Under the Indian Act, they were supposed to be responsible for food, education, shelter, which included housing. The housing responsibilities was then decentralized. I believe it was in, I just seen Bill go by. He was one of the former presidents of the UNN. And I believe it was during the time when Bill was president that this decentralization of that responsibility was transferred to the provinces. So again, what they were doing is was breaking that direct link between us as Aboriginal people in Ottawa by transferring the responsibilities to the provinces. So then again, you have more hoops to drop, to jump through in order to come to an end product. Okay, we've gone through 1969. Now I'm going to bring you up to 1985, which is Bill C-31, which is something that Frank talked about. That bill did not only deal with the inadequacies of women marrying non-Native men. It had to deal with people that went to serve in World War I and World War II that were disenfranchised because they were Indian and were no longer allowed to be Indians. It also had to deal with people who left the reserve for any length of time for more than 6 months, and they were disenfranchised. They were not allowed to be Indian anymore. That bill also had to do with people. And you must remember that during this time too, like when my father went to school in the first Indian residential school, the only vocation that was open to him was to become a minister, nothing else. And I always look at our education system. They either want us to be ministers or they want us to be school teachers. No, the thrust isn't for us to be lawyers, but never an overall decision about which way we want to go ourselves. So there were 17 distinct divisions as to why people became disenfranchised, and they tried to rectify that through Bill C-31 in 1985. And as Frank told you, and if you talk and if you listen to Rose Charlie tomorrow, I think she'll tell you the same thing. We still have alphabet soup Indians. It means only through very specialized types of sections are you allowed to get your status. And when you do get your status, the government has not made an exact responsibility in regard to their benefits that you receive as a status person. So that's still an ongoing issue. When you look at British Columbia and colonization, and when British Columbia came in much later than after 1867 into Confederation, it's interesting. Because the first Governor General of British Columbia was Douglas, and he was a real different person. And that's why you see different treaties even today that are in around Victoria. And then shortly after Douglas, Trutch took power. And with Trutch came Confederation. And the attitude that still prevails today has not changed provincially. They will not deal with Aboriginal title. It is not within their mandate, and that was established when they joined Confederation. So when you look at history today and its impacts that it has on us, it's long-reaching. But we never say die, because we're still here. We're still fighting, and we're still going on. And it is only through the help of people like yourself that are opened. And in our language, we say, "Amqaqalqut." It means when your heart is open and you're receptive to hear the truth, then things will move for a change. So thank you very much, and I'm going to leave it as an open panel now. Thank you.